Welcome to Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here, and today we start the show by talking about perennials, which I think are the backbone of many a garden here in our state. The American Horticultural Society has a new book out. It's called Essential Guide to Perennial Gardening, Techniques and Know-How for Planning, Planting, and Tending Low-Maintenance Perennial Plantings. And here to tell us about it, Matt Mattis. He is an American Horticultural Society member. He's an author and horticulturist, and really great to have him with us today. And want to hear from you. What questions do you have about your perennials? Are you looking maybe for a low-maintenance perennial for your garden? What other questions do you have? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Matt Mattis, welcome. Tell us about the American Horticultural Society. What's your mission?
Oh, sure. Thank you, Larry. I'm excited to be here. Well, I am the Senior Director of Horticulture at the American Horticultural Society, which I think which is really, you know, experiencing a resurgence now in popularity. There's so many plant societies across the country, but to have one that's national and one that's from, let's say, the early 20th century, from, you know, 1920 or so, it's just a great organization. It has a great publication. We have a bi-monthly magazine, which I think a lot of people don't know about, but it's if you're a plant geek or a plant nerd or a vegetable gardener or a perennial gardener, I think you'd find it eye-opening. So, yeah, we hit every state in the country.
And you have a really cool farm. It's called River Farm as your headquarters. Tell us about River Farm. I thought it was really cool.
Yeah, that was actually part of George Washington's original property on the Delaware. So a very historic site. It's open to the public. It's also a botanic garden and a great old farmhouse there. And you know, people have their weddings there. It's, you know, what you would do at a normal botanic garden, but also it houses the American Horticultural Society.
Yeah. I know the AHS, American Horticultural Society, offers a number of educational opportunities. Maybe you could talk about the kinds of educational opportunities you offer.
Oh, sure. Well, we have people who, no matter where you live in the country, right, you can participate in things like, we have AHS Explore, which is a fantastic travel program. Traveling, you know, this year we're going to Japan, we're going to Ireland next year, to the Netherlands. It's a lot of people take advantage of that. And there's different levels of tours, even in the country, like Santa Fe. So if you love gardens and you want, you know, art and culture mixed in, those are great trips. We have something called the AHS Garden Network, which is really a fantastic deal where you get discounts at all of the partner botanic gardens around the country. So from in New England here, the New England Botanic Garden or the New York Botanic Garden or on the West Coast, you don't have to pay full admission. Sometimes it's free admission, and there are other benefits that come with that. So that's a big one that members enjoy. And then there's AHS Live, which is, you know, where no matter where you are, if you have a computer and you can take classes, online learning series, and all different levels from beginners to experts. And those are really focused, you know, we're doing, some have been like on pollinator gardens with Kelly Norris or planting vegetable gardens. I think people really enjoy that. So you can see it's truly a national organization. And I think the best benefit is the American Gardener magazine, which is an award-winning magazine. And you only get it if you're a member, so it's really worth it. It's really one of America's premier gardening magazines and worth checking out.
The book, I mean, AHS has published a number of gardening books, and the one we'll kind of focus on today is titled Essential Guide to Perennial Gardening, Techniques and Know-How for Planning, Planting, and Tending Low-Maintenance Perennial Plantings. What makes a good gardening reference book in your mind?
I think a good gardening book would, you know, provide information for a gardener as he or she grows, right? So some of us are beginners, some of us are experts. I think you can learn something from any book, but I, you know, particularly with me, I like to have a book that I'm always learning something with. And this one does that. I mean, I wrote a book on flower gardening, right? But the information that's in this is it's covers a little bit of everything. So whereas, let's say, my book doesn't cover design of a garden, for instance, or how do you work with the soil. So if you're brand new to perennial gardening, this book is helpful. If you're an expert, it covers sort of new trends in perennial gardening.
Yeah, there's a lot in this book, and I love the photos you do and the diagrams. You do such an the book does such a nice job of explaining things, and then we get to see the flowers, the perennials, and we get to see how they're located in a landscape for really good ideas, you know, for your own landscape.
Yeah, no matter where you live, I think a lot of the older perennial books tended to focus, let's say, on an English approach, like an English border. And, you know, perennials became very popular again in the 1980s. So a lot of Americans with backyards or front yards wanted to have that English border or that cottage garden. But in our modern life, things have changed. We don't have gardeners. We don't have time to spend, you know, with a 15-foot deep border. This book covers all sorts of perennials. So if you have a shady yard, if you have a woodland garden, that's where perennials live. If you have a full sunny farm border, you know, and you want pollinators in it, this book goes into that sort of detail. I don't know many new perennial books that cover these new trends, like I want a pollinator, or I want to plant a border with natives, or maybe I want some natives, some grasses, some pollinator plants, and some old-fashioned, you know, cottage perennials all together. So, you know, we've changed how we garden, and this book addresses that.
It does indeed. Martha in Menominee, Wisconsin, has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Martha.
Hi, Larry. I'm so excited. Here's my plan. I want to grow lupine. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. I saw it growing up in northern Wisconsin near a riverbed. I don't have a riverbed in my yard, but I do have a low wet spot. Can I grow lupine in my yard?
Yeah, absolutely. Hi, Martha. I love lupins. Lupins or lupine, there's no wrong way to say it because botanical Latin was not a spoken language. But I think you're one of the best parts of the country to be able to grow lupins because of, you know, the cooler summers than, let's say, we would have you know, in the south or in the sub-Atlantic area. So, yes, you should be able to grow them. I mean, how wet does it get?
Well, I just have some low spots in my yard that typically are soppy, you know, and it takes a few days longer to dry up. They do get full sun, you know, it does get full sun there. So I'm thinking it's worth a try. What do you think?
I think so. They enjoy moisture. They don't want to be soaking wet, but as long as it drains, it's still damp. The lupins do not want to dry out, so I would think that's probably a good condition to try them. And full sun definitely will help.
Yeah. Martha, good luck with that. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, by the way. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. For new gardeners, explain what a perennial is.
Oh, sure. So a perennial is any plant that's an herbaceous plant. So an herbaceous plant is a plant that, say, emerges from the ground, that grows up in the spring and summer, and then in the autumn it dies back to the ground again, mostly right to the ground again. And you may see dead stalks or seed pods, and then reemerges again the following year. And most perennials can be, you know, obviously the word perennial comes back every year, whereas, let's say, a biennial, which is a little more confusing of a term, would be a plant that maybe has to grow for a whole year or two and then bloom, and then it completes its life and sets seed again, like foxgloves, for instance, or hollyhocks. But a perennial would come back every year. There are things that are, you know, make not be too confusing, but there are things that are called short-lived perennials. And lupins, what we just talked about, would be one of those, where a lupin, especially a hybrid, like a Russell hybrid, may come back for 2 or 3 years, or a Columbine, and then start to fade away and get a little weaker, and often they self-seed and will come up somewhere else. So they last more than 2 years. But snapdragons actually could be a mild, sort of short-lived perennial in warmer climates. But generally, it's a plant that comes back. But there are very long-lived perennials, like peonies, that could last 100 years.
Yeah, absolutely. And the new book, I really like this one feature of the book. It features 150 plant profiles and with some great photos. How did you decide on those 150?
I know, it's a bit of a beauty contest, right? Well, so what's interesting about these plant profiles, because yes, you do want to include something that everyone will like, but instead of including all the common perennials, we try to include perennials that, you know, are new in the trade or new to even conventional perennial growers. You know, something like Amsonia, which is a native subshrub or a native perennial that you'll see, you know, planted in these meadow plantings that are so popular now. A lot of those plants are added in here. So a lot of these sort of naturalizing plants, so people who plant matrices of plants, so every foot, you know, 1 foot apart on a grid of grasses and then interplanted with bulbs and interplanted with another perennial, those types of perennials made it in here. So we try not to include the real common ones that you know, but also some of the ones that people, you know, maybe have trouble growing, like hollyhocks, or newer ones in the trade, like alstroemeria. Some of the new hybrids like Allium Millennium, like these have different uses in the garden now. And these plants were not available 7-10 years ago.
Yeah, it's great. And the other thing I really liked about those profiles is that, all right, in this little block, for you've got a photo of the perennial, but then you have a lot of really useful information, shorthand information, about the conditions, sun amount, the heat tolerances.
Pruning. I mean, we've included some, you know, what people think of as rhizomes or bulbs, like, you know, bearded iris or cannas even. People often are confused. What do I do with them in the fall? Can I cut them back? Are they hardy in zone 7, which they are, but in zone 6, they're not. So do I dig them up or not?
It's like a
baseball card.
Yeah, it's like a baseball. You're right. It's like a baseball card, but gives you a lot of really good information packed in each one of those cards that makes for a very quick reference. I really like that.
Oh, good. Yeah, it gives you the stats, so you get the basics.
Matt Natt is our guest today. He is an American Horticultural Society member, horticulturist, and author, and we're talking with him about perennials today on the show. You can join in with your questions. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mehler for Garden Talk on WPR News. Great to have you along today for Garden Talk. Larry Mehler here with my guest, Matt Mattis, American Horticultural Society member, horticulturist and author, and the book we're talking about is the AHS book, Essential Guide to Perennial Gardening. And so talking perennials with him, and you can join in at 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. Let's take a call from Lucy in Waupaca. Lucy, hello. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. I have a swamp mallow hibiscus. Am I saying that right?
Yeah. Sure. Either. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. But anyway, I want to propagate it, and I don't know if I should propagate it from seed or...
Oh, we lost Lucy.
Oh, how
does she propagate it? Does she do it from seed or cuttings?
From seed. Yeah, absolutely from seed. So a swamp mallow, I mean, you would want to, so it's a hibiscus. I mean, it's actually the hibiscus, I believe, that they made marshmallow from, that sort of mucilage that was in the liquid in the stems back in the old days. But it's definitely from seed, like most mallows. And so that's in the hibiscus family. So a Malvaceae would be the hibiscus family. But definitely the seeds, which you would have to stratify for, maybe, which means provide them sort of a cold. You could do it in the refrigerator. I probably wouldn't freeze them, even though in the wild they freeze. I think a damp cold, like wrap the seed up in a damp paper towel, put it in a poly bag, put it in your refrigerator for maybe 4 to 6 weeks, and then sow the seeds. You can sow the seeds under lights. And so you could do it a bit early, let's say in March. So maybe the timing is right. So you still have time to chill them and to start them and keep them under lights, of course, until after any threat of frost, and then transplant them out into the garden.
And one of the features of this book, by the way, is propagation. And I know you have some good photos and some good information on plant propagation.
Yeah, it's a whole section on plant propagation. And, you know, propagation could be something as simple as digging up, let's say, a perennial that grew too old in the garden. After 5 or 6 years, they form like a shape like a tire in the ground, so they're dead in the center, and it's a ring. I don't know if you've seen that.
Yes.
In your garden, right? So, it, you know, from that, let's say it's an aster or even a daylily, you can get, you know, 6 plants, maybe even more. And certainly with hostas and things like that, a heuchera. But that's the easiest way. But then also we go into root cuttings, stem cuttings. We mentioned earlier, we talked about the lupin. That's something in, you know, the old timers used to cut the roots and root and pot the roots up horizontally in a seed tray, and the root cuttings would grow, or stem cuttings in March, which is how you would propagate delphiniums, for instance.
We get a lot of questions over time about plant propagation, and that's why I thought, this is a valuable source of information in this book, for sure. Lucy, thanks again for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's go to Gianni in Montello next. Hi, Gianni.
Yes, good morning, Matt and Larry. Thank you for taking my call. My question regards lingonberries. I spent some time in central Sweden, and we, in the summertime, we picked lingonberries in the forest. My question is, are they native to the New World, or were they introduced here, and why aren't they cultivated here like the cranberry? Because they are absolutely delicious, but very, very dear when you buy them.
They are. I agree. I live in a Swedish neighborhood, so in Massachusetts, so I'm familiar with lingonberries. And it's funny you ask this, because I agree with you. I have never seen them offered here or grown here, but they can be, and certainly where you are and where I live in the country. I know they're available now online. You can Google. There's one retailer that sells them, and I'm going to be trying them this year, so I can't speak to how successful they are. But I know that they're sort of a high-acid soil plant like blueberries. It's certainly something worth trying. I can't speak to how well they'll grow, but it seems like they were grown, I know, back in the colonial times. So, and especially through like Nova Scotia, Canada.
Yeah, the soil type is kind of the problem, and people certainly grow lingonberries in Wisconsin, but to make that soil, our basic soil, acidic enough, it requires. What should I say? Fairly constant attention to the soil.
Yeah, but I know people who grow them in pots. So
yeah.
It's probably easier to keep.
Yes.
You probably would have to go peat-based, which we're all trying to use less peat these days. But it's probably easier to keep the soil. It's certainly not the temperature, because they're zone 2 plants. You
yeah.
know, so they probably grow better in northern Canada.
Yeah.
Or Sweden.
And the soil type's a little better there, too, I think, for them as well. Johnny, there you go. Thank you for calling. Dave and Toma, your turn. Hi, Dave.
Well, I wanted to ask you a couple of things. Blueberries and mulberries. Number one, are mulberries, I've never had one. Are they worth eating? Are they good?
I'm sure there's a mulberry council, but I would say they're not that sweet. I mean, they're ornamental cultivars that have, you know, weeping foliage. You know, you often see these in cemeteries, or, you know, it's like a weeping willow form, or fancy leaves on them. But there are cultivars that have very large fruit. But I would say there's probably a reason you don't see mulberry jam sold at the supermarket, right? But they certainly have their fans. I know they're very popular in Asia, and there are cultivars, which I have not tasted, but that are grown commercially.
Yeah.
I think it's a short-lived plant, and they can be messy. The fruit drops.
Yes, it does. Thank you, Dave, for calling. Appreciate your call. And then you have to keep the birds away.
No, that's part of the messy part, right? I mean, Don't park under them.
Lynn in Eau Claire, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Lynn.
Hi. This might be a little bit dumb, but can you put weed and seed on your flower bed? I know there's preen, but what about the regular, you know, you buy a big bag for your yard. Can you put that on your flower bed?
I would say just do it carefully. There are plant people, let's say really plant geeks who grow alpine plants in, you know, a gravel elevated bed, and they actually use, a weed and feed because it doesn't seem to harm some alpine plants. But you need to know what genus you have with species and are they sensitive to it, because obviously it can kill a weed. So you can certainly, you know, kill half of or everything you have at the same time.
Yeah.
Probably experiment it on something first.
Yeah, we could turn to a minute to your section on nutrients and soil chemistry, which I found really interesting. You even had five myths about plant nutrients and soil chemistry that I thought were kind of fun and interesting as well.
Yeah, you have to be careful. Of course, you know, in our modern world, we're more educated, we're more sensitive to what we put in our soil, on our soil, the health of our soil, the microorganisms. And I think, you know, any serious gardener would say don't use a weed and feed. But I do know people that use it, say, on a lawn or in a garden maybe where you're growing a monoculture or one plant that you know is sensitive to it. I mean, environmentally, it's probably not wise. But, I mean, that's a decision that's up to you.
Yeah, yeah. And I think one of the myths you had, organic is always safe.
Oh, right. I mean, I think chemicals are chemicals, and this comes up all the time amongst plant people on, you know, what's a good source of nitrogen. And, you know, we may have one that, you know, comes from the oil industry, but also will a plant know the difference between the chemical? So the chemistry obviously factors in. I guess the best bit of advice is just to educate yourself as much as possible to what you're putting on. An organic insecticide or herbicide can be just as dangerous. Vinegar in many ways is more dangerous to your soil than, you know, another chemical source, but it's an acid. It's still a chemical. So be careful.
Diana in Gladstone, Michigan. It's your turn. Hi.
Okay. Larry and guest. Hello. So we moved into a new house last year, and I have two gardens, and one is completely shady, and the other one is partially sunny, but, you know, like half is sunny. So half the side grows good, but the other half doesn't. Of course, I wasn't thinking when I put it in. So I'm just wondering, two questions. Anything flowering that I could actually put in a more shady area and that the deer won't eat?
Oh, well, that's a good, you know, good thing. I'm glad you brought up deer, because this book is, I'm impressed with how many of these plants that are in here that the deer will not eat. Or there's no plant a deer won't eat, but let's say deer resistant. Either might be because the leaves are furry or they're prickly or the plant doesn't taste good. But on the shady side, there are certainly things like Alchemilla mollis, that's a lady's mantle that has beautiful lime green flowers and foamy airiness, and you could have campanulas coming out of that. I personally have a mostly shady garden, so I know there are a lot of things. Podophyllum, things that have interesting foliage do well. Kerengi shoma, I think we overlook those plants that bloom in September, October. Kerengi shoma from Korea has beautiful golden waxy bells. There are plenty of plants in here that you could grow in shade. Columbine, certainly.
There are a number of them, but it's a question that we often get, Matt. People would love to have flowers, you know, blooming in shade.
Yeah. Well, you know, an easy way around that is go to your local garden center, but just don't go in May. Go through the summer months and go into late summer, autumn. An astilbe may not be blooming till June or July, and so many of us just go to the garden center in May and June, and that's it. So you'll see what's in bloom, and then you can choose the colors you want. And especially getting later into summer, that's when I think a lot of shade gardens tend to go. Either the ephemerals go away and you're left with not much, or just grasses or hosta. But you certainly can find more interesting plants to be added in late summer, fall, too.
Yeah, I think that's a really good tip, for sure. Diana, thanks again for calling. You can join in, too, 800-642-1234. Or you could email to talk@wpr.org, get you on pretty quickly. Nancy in Wautoma emailed to ask what perennials to plant on top of a septic drain field. She would love to restore a lawn area with prairie plants, and she appreciates deep-rooted perennials impacting, or she's apprehensive about deep-rooted perennials impacting the drain field.
Oh, that's a good question. I don't have experience planting on a drain field, but I have planted on them things like peonies. Or is it full sun?
I don't know.
So it's probably better than lawn. I mean, your grass is usually greener there, right?
Yeah.
High nitrogen. I don't know. I think you'd have to. I would think there's more plants that grow there than don't. If it's an active drain field, too, I'm not sure how deep, when she is talking about deep-rooted perennials.
She was a little worried about them having some impact on the drain field. I would suggest, and I know for sure, for example, that Prairie Nursery in Plainfield, Wisconsin, has a list of plants, of prairie plants that can grow on a drain field. And that person might just check Prairie Nursery or some of the other native plant nurseries that are in the state and take a look at their website, because I know they do offer some possibilities. So certainly worth a look. Miranda emailed to ask what seeds should be winter sowed for perennials. She wants to use milk jugs and a water bottle method, and did start a few already, including hollyhock, lupin, and poppies. Are there others she should and could still put out, or is it better to start inside now?
Yes, that's a really good question. I mean, personally, I don't support the milk jug method at all. You probably would only limit that to seedlings that don't mind being transplanted, things like poppies or even lupins when they get larger, or milkweed, don't want their roots disturbed at all. So unless you put three seeds in a jug that are 2 inches, 3 inches apart, and you can carefully separate them, I would never tear. Mm-hmm. I've seen this, you know, often suggested on social media, you know, tear the root ball off. But cold seed starting outdoors certainly is one method. Mine sit in, you know, 2 or 3 inch pots right now with gravel on top outside in the snow, no covering. So the idea of making a mini greenhouse, which is the method of taking a milk jug, heats it up too warm on a sunny day, especially in February and March. Then it gets down cold again at night, is not helping those plants at all. They're much better if they germinate naturally, let's say in mid-April, early May, for pots that have been outside all winter, for those that require it. You would have to look online and see which, but I see a lot of suggestions, again, on social media, of plants that really don't need to be started in, especially poppies, for instance, which do not need cold stratification at all. the fact that they can survive in the cold is, I think, confuses people. Oh. You know, there's no need to sow on snow. There's no they germinate at 80 degrees, 90 degrees, or that first warm spring day. So you're better off sowing those maybe later in spring than in the winter.
Yeah, and it reminds me about climate. We have a rapidly changing climate. How much should we consider that when selecting perennials?
Well, I mean, I suppose there's good news there that we can start trying some different warmer ones that are better in warmer climates or zones. But, you know, at least here in New England, we get unpredictable springs. I don't know what you have there, but
yes.
Perennials that emerge too quickly, let's say, in spring, because let's say we had a warm winter and they started growing, and then we have a cold spell and it's 10 degrees, it's 5 degrees for 3 days, and that new growth is damaged. That happens more often now than it ever has before. So we're all trying to navigate those waters now.
Yeah, for sure. Gail is on the road to Madison and couldn't stay with us, but wondering if Milorganite is good to work into the soil of her perennial beds in the spring.
Oh, that's a great question. I can't answer it. I've never used it.
Yeah,
it's like a high nitrogen feed, right?
Yeah.
Or at least, you know, it's more like fish fertilizer in a way, I think, in its formula. So it's, just looking at the analysis of it, I would put it on snow or earlier in the year before plants are emerging.
Merritt in Wausau emailed to say they aren't flowering, but ferns are very deer resistant, and there are so many beautiful types of ferns available.
That's a good point. Yeah, and I love ferns. We keep adding more and more to our garden, and they just look great, too.
Yeah, absolutely. Matt Mattis, our guest today, I should mention, coming up in the second hour of the show, we'll be taking a look at buying and caring for houseplants with the owner of the Madison Greenhouse Store, Tiffany Olson. So that's later on. Right now, though, we're looking at perennials with Matt. And you can join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. You're listening to Garden Talk here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, right now visiting about perennials. And Judy in Madison has a question for you, Matt.
Hello.
Hi, Judy.
I had a pot of calla lilies last fall, and as they faded and died, I saved the seeds. So what do you recommend now for doing with those seeds in order to maybe get them to grow?
Okay.
All right. So, Julie, you had seeds or are the bulbs in the pot?
No, the seeds that were at the blossoms.
Oh, okay. So those you can sow right away. Hopefully they're still, I'm not sure if they'll still be vital or not, but they're really a berry. It's an aroid, so they're more like berry-like. But I would try sowing now. I have not grown them from seed. I've only divided the bulbs. Do you still have the pot?
Yes, I do.
So I would dig down into the pot and see if there's, a bulb still down in there. And that's sort of your backup plan.
Okay.
Start watering that and see how that grows.
Okay. There you go, Judy. Thank you for calling. Jen in Ashland will go to you now. Hi, Jen.
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to comment. The gentleman that called earlier about lingonberries, I live up near Ashland, and I grow them in a raised bed. I have a lot of pine trees, so my native soil is really acidic. So I use the soil from my yard in the raised bed. And I have about 8 plants. They're very small, and they do really well. They don't produce a ton of berries, but we get enough for a few handfuls, and we stew them and put them on pancakes or crepes or what have you. So they're pretty easy to grow, and I would totally encourage him to give it a try.
That's great.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks, Jen. And Matt, I should tell you that we have a pretty broad audience here, and the audience consists of everything from first-time gardeners to folks who have completed the many iterations of the Master Gardener program. So oftentimes, if somebody asks a question, somebody will pipe up with their experience, which is always good to have. Thanks again, Jen. Karen in St. Croix Falls will go to you now. Hi, Karen.
Hello.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Happy Valentine's Day.
To you as well.
I bought a new house, and I am an avid gardener, but I've always wanted a perennial garden. And what is the number one tip you can give me for starting out? I'm thinking you're going to say the soil, but I'm all ears.
I am going to say the soil. Well, this, how, if your new house is a new construction?
Yes, and
so
I'm going to be landscaping.
Problem. Yeah. Well, I mean, there's nothing you can't overcome. The problem with new construction homes is often the ground is too, the soil's too compacted. When we built our greenhouse here, we had tractors come in and ran over, you know, 150-year-old garden. And then it took 10 years for the garden to come back to normal because the soil is compacted. But so you'll probably have to condition your soil a bit, you know, add some conditioner in. I'm not sure what your soil's like, but you should know as an experienced gardener once you turn it over. If it's too disturbed or it's, you know, maybe they brought soil in, you may have to enhance the soil. But you absolutely would. This is the time to start a perennial garden.
Yeah, absolutely. Karen, good luck with it. Thank you very much for calling. That compacted soil would be a...
Yeah, organic matter, get a lot in there. Compost, if you can even order it from a place, or even turning in, you know, composted wood bark. Order a big load of mulch and let it sit for a year or two and then add that in too.
Yeah, good points. Karen, good luck. Thank you. Joel in Green Bay up next. Hi, Joel.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm new to gardening in the house, and I was wondering if I would be able to grow some perennials in the house. I have a few plants already, and they're doing really good. I have a south-facing window, which is the only window that faces south, so I'm limited to that. I was wondering if I could grow perennials in the house.
That's an interesting question, a popular thing to do in the 19th century, especially in colder climates where people would dig, you know, astilbes, for instance, were often sold as an Easter plant or even at Valentine's Day forced. So, I mean, obviously if they're outdoor plants, they need a dormant and cool period to rest. You know, maybe you have a garage or you have some place outside where they can go for a bit, but bring them back indoors. I mean, technically, most houseplants are perennials, you know, but they're tropical. But it's going to take some experimentation, but I know that Tova Martin, the writer, is working on an article for us for a future issue on growing perennials in the house. I think it's more about forcing perennials in, so you have a cool bedroom or unheated room that you can bring them in. But I say go for it. You're going to have to learn on the way with this one because I don't think there's a lot of information out there if they're garden perennials. But if they're growing for you, go for it.
And we'll be talking about houseplants coming up in our next segment. And I can raise that issue with our guest at that time as well, who works a lot with houseplants. Joel, so thank you for calling. Carmen in Sturgeon Bay will turn to you next. Hi, Carmen.
Oh, good morning. I'm calling because I have a prickly pear cactus in a flower garden that I need to move this spring. And I'm looking for some recommendations on transplanting a prickly pear cactus.
And gloves.
Yeah, gloves.
Yeah. Well, you certainly, I would try and move it early before the new pads come out. And, you know, some of the tricks that people have is they use rolled up newspaper. I mean, if they still have newspapers and kind of wrap and use that to pick the plant up with. But if you're doing it with a shovel, do it before the new growth because those new pads can be very limp. You don't want them to limp and not be turgid full of water. Or wait until they've matured, let's say in July or late June, and move it then.
All right, Carmen, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Leslie in Cottage Grove emailed, back to mulberries for a minute. She has a mulberry tree and harvests and freezes as much as she can. She thinks they're a superfood. She eats them on her cereal every day. They don't have much taste, but if they're an easy and free superfood, that's fine with her. Biggest benefit with mulberries, it attract lots of birds. The most entertaining guests are the cedar waxwings, of course. They eat the overripe berries and, well, get drunk and fly around intoxicated. Truly a hoot.
That's great. Well, they are superfood. They're high in vitamin C, that's for sure. The birds know that.
Phil in Mount Horeb, we'll go to you. Hi, Phil.
I'd love to know what that proper dimension is for cold or duration for setting seeds that need that cold period.
That's a really good question. There's a lot of confusion about this and a lot of misinformation. I'm going to give you a book to go look for online. It's a free PDF you can download. It's at a lot of rock garden sites. It's called Seed Germination Theory and Practice, and it's by Dr. Norman Deno, D-E-N-O. And it's like a 300-page photocopied book that's been passed around, you know, plant collectors for, you know, 15, 20 years now. But it will tell you what seeds need to be stratified for how long and which ones don't. Like, you know, Rudbeckia, I mean, a lot of people are sowing those in jugs. They don't need to be chilled, or foxgloves, or, as I said earlier, poppies. In fact, all the annual poppies do not need to be cold. They all germinate above 70, ideally closer to 90. So that's, you need to, it really depends on every plant.
And
but, even like cardinal flower doesn't need to be chilled at all.
So I'm sure there are people saying, wait a minute, what was the title of that free book?
Yeah, it's called, say it slowly, Seed Germination Theory and Practice. It's a bit of a science-y book, but there's a lot of information in there. I think there's probably over 1,000 plants listed. And the author's name is Norman C. Deno, D-E-N-O. He was a professor of chemistry.
Phil, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. I appreciate your call. In the book, the book, again, I'll give the title of the book we've been sort of zeroing in a bit on. It's the title is Essential Guide to Perennial Gardening. That's the main title. The subtitle, Techniques and Know-How for Planning, Planting and Tending, Low Maintenance, Perennial Plantings. A really nice book filled with photos written in a way that any of us can understand, which I also like a whole lot. And in the book, you talk about gardening as an ecosystem.
Yeah, it's a real trend now, and there are good reasons for it. I think we forget, right? The garden's part of our ecosystem.
Yeah, and become a kind of an ecosystem in and among themselves, in and of itself, I should say.
It is, and it's not just saying grow only natives. You know, certainly there are guides in the book where if you're interested in growing only natives, you can. But I think you know, the reality is we're mixing a little bit of everything: Asiatic plants from around the world, which is important too because diversity is important in the plant world. You know, there are trilliums here in North America, and there are even more trillium species elsewhere in the world. And maybe some of those are endangered, or mayapples in China are endangered. So we maybe should have all six species in our garden here to help keep, you know, the whole genus alive. So we, you know, we try to encourage, you know, build the garden you want, but also build it in a smart way so the ecology of that garden is good for the plants, for the wildlife, and for you.
Yeah, I was thinking about some of the perennial beds that I have. I have a perennial bed between the sidewalk and the street. So it's a fairly narrow area, but it's really pretty. throughout the summer. If I ever sell my house, I'm going to sell it in July because all of those perennials, or many of them, are in full bloom at that time.
Oh, yeah, smart.
They've been in now for quite a while, and I'm wondering about dividing. They're great because they last a long time, but in many cases, that means you need to divide at some point. How do you know when to do it?
Well, it depends on the plant, of course, but it is safe to say that not all perennials want to be divided, first of all. So, you know, something, again, like it's a lupin or a peony or something that has a brittle root or a deep root or a baptisia. I mean, good luck trying to divide that. But the ones that you'll notice them slowly spreading and forming a clump, those generally are, you know, should be divided or divided, repotted, and given away to friends and family every 3 to 5 years. The plants will just be better, and you're getting a lot of free plants.
Yeah, you really are. Another question here we've got. Many perennials bloom once a year. Are there ways to increase bloom time on perennials?
Not really, but there are ways to, depending on the perennial, there are ways to delay bloom or to encourage a longer season. So let's say, something that, let's say a phlox. If it's a tall phlox in your perennial border and you do what they call the Chelsea chop, which is you pinch out the stems in end of May or beginning of June, that could delay blooming. But a trick is to perhaps do that to only half your stems. So the first batch of will bloom in June and then into July, and the ones that you pinched will bloom a little bit later, like 3 or 4 weeks later.
That's a very, very...
A Veronica you can do that with, too.
Yeah, that's a very, very good tip. And I think for some natives, when you put the seeds in will make a difference on flowering as well. Some flower late, some flower early. And so when you put those seeds in, you need to keep that in mind as well, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. Absolutely. And, you know, it's challenging today because you buy plants at garden centers, and a lot of these plants came from, you know, gardens further south than where you live. Around here, they come maybe from Pennsylvania, so they're two zones ahead of us in the spring. But they want to sell these plants when they're in bloom. But the following year in your own garden, they may bloom 4 weeks later than they did the year before. Yeah. So it's a little misleading. So this book, we try to put out the actual timing of these plants.
So how do people get the American Horticultural Society book, Essential Guide to Perennial Gardening?
Well, the book is available, let's say, you know, wherever books are sold, but definitely on Amazon and other online book sources. It's called The Essential Guide to Perennial Gardening, and you'll see right on the cover the big pink flower logo for the American Horticultural Society. There's a companion book that's called Organic Vegetable Gardening. It's the same shape and sort of same design cover, so it's a great companion to that. But they're both out now. They just were published and available across the country.
Yeah, and it's a dandy book on perennials, I'll tell you that for sure. Matt, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I hope we can do this again. Would you be willing to come back at some point?
I would love to. Thank you, Larry.
It's been a pleasure. Matt Mattis, American Horticulture Society member, horticulturist, and author. And the book we've been talking about again, Essential Guide to Perennial Gardening, subtitled Techniques and Know-How for Planning, Planting, and Tending Low-Maintenance Perennial Plantings. Take a look at it for sure. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.